Welcome to Writers on Writing. I'm your host, Marie Stone. Today, I welcome back Tessa Hadley, last on the show with me in 2016. Tessa is the author of 8 novels and 3 collections of short fiction. She's also a regular contributor to The New Yorker's fiction column. She joined me to talk about her latest novel, Free Love. We chatted about coming to publishing later in life, how Tessa found her confidence as a novelist, how she accomplishes her nuanced sex scenes, and so much more. Enjoy the conversation. Tessa Hadley, welcome back.
Lovely to be here.
So the last time we spoke was in February of 2016. What a difference 6 years make.
And, yeah, I know. Who could have predicted all this?
All of it. So I was thinking, you know, certainly your short story Coda in the New Yorker last August hit the pandemic head on. But before we dive into this book, and maybe it's a way to talk about this book, I was wondering how and if you have felt the events of the past few years have influenced the work and, you know, kind of if you can feel the external world impacting your creative world.
It must do, because one lives in the world and it changes your perspective and your vision. But I think I'm not, I mean, Coda, that short story you mentioned is unusual. I'm usually wary of reflecting what's happening around us too immediately. So in fact, writing Free Love, which is my new novel, I was incredibly relieved that I'd completely by chance set it in the 1960s so that I didn't have to address the pandemic. It would have been very odd to have started a novel set in the contemporary world and then been hit by what happened with COVID and had to sort of think on, you know, on the hoof, as it were, of how to, what to do with that in terms of the story and the style and the whole thing that you'd planned. So that was just a lucky chance, really.
It's interesting you say that, because and we can get into this more as we unpack the novel, but the choice to set it in the 1960s, I feel like I've been having so many conversations with people of late about the parallels between current world and 1960s world, the tumultuousness, the return to all these conversations about the civil rights movement, you know, whether or not that time of life was as disruptive as this time of life. So I think even though it's completely divorced in time, there are all these kind of interesting intersections between those two times where there's interesting conversations to be had. And certainly in this book, a lot of life is disrupted.
I think what I felt was more that I was doing a bit of archaeology in a way, and I was looking for origins, and I was looking for origins for the last half century, and I was looking back to the 60s where so many foundational changes, a sort of change of direction between one world and another world, certainly in the UK, but obviously in a much wider sense, obviously in America and in Europe, where that was happening. But I think you're right that I wonder if what sent me back to do that archaeological digging in the past was a sense of another equivalent moment of transition, a bit less positive feeling, at least at present. I mean, there was a lot of naive hopefulness around in the 60s, I think, as well as some panic from, if you like, the rear guard. But there's more confusion now about quite what we might be looking forward to. But maybe it is another opportunity as well.
It's interesting to look back over the, you know, kind of the bulk of your work and see some of these recurring themes. And one of them that is bubbling up as we're talking about this is the loss of innocence. And I feel like, you know, that was really present in this book. And I think that has really been present in the last couple of years in our national discourse and international discourse, the loss of innocence. And that seems like something you've been interested in for a long time. I don't know, subconsciously or consciously, if you feel like that's true.
I probably do, although I'm probably a little bit equivocal about it. I mean, if I'm thinking about Free Love, I suppose what would one be talking about? The loss of a more innocent way of life, which was more settled, more hierarchical, more clear about values, and yet so many of those values and those hierarchies were brutal and cruel and exclusive. And in fact, you know, my novel actually has the Second World War, 15 years in its, or 20 years behind it. So, you know, not so innocent, not so harmless. But if Phyllis, I suppose, loses her innocence, although I don't know, in a funny way, she, if you can do such a thing as get your innocence, maybe she almost goes out into, crosses some sort of threshold into a new way of living and thinking. But there's an innocent hopefulness, perhaps even a foolish innocence at moments, about the change in her. So innocent, I mean, the loss of innocence is always interesting. It's a great subject for fiction, but often it's not just something to be lamented. Innocence perhaps is dangerous. I suppose that's what I think.
I love that regaining of innocence. That's really,
I've never thought about that before, and it's sort of odd. Kind of like getting your virginity back or something.
Right. Yes, exactly. Well, before we get too far ahead of ourselves, I guess we should introduce the novel. We should give a chance for our listeners to catch up with us. So talk a little bit about the book, about Phyllis, and maybe we can also talk about where the origin story of this was, where it came from for you.
It is a book about a tectonic shift that took place in the 1960s, and it's set in and around London. And it begins with a very settled, contented seeming bourgeois housewife who is married to a very decent, good man, a civil servant. She has two children, a daughter of 15 and a little boy. And everything in her life seems sort of bright and sunlit and established. And then one mad night, a young man comes to their house. They have him to dinner. Nothing special about it. He's a son of old friends of theirs. And in the garden, in the dark, really slightly randomly, because he thinks he ought to do something unbourgeois, he kisses Phyllis. And what he doesn't know is that he sets off a train of consequences in her, and then in their wide, in her family and in the world around them, because she, for her, it's a pivotal moment in imagining herself and her fulfillment and her life. And she suddenly thinks she's missed out on passion, missed out on everything. She follows him across a threshold into another world of things happening in West London at that moment in Ladbroke Grove, where the counterculture is kind of unrolling and people are, you know, men are growing their hair long, people are wearing crazy clothes and taking drugs and listening to rock music. And she crosses the threshold into all of that, and in order to follow Nicky, and huge from there consequences ripple out through the rest of the novel. And everybody is changed by that, coming from that minute first moment in the dark garden.
Where did the book start for you? What was the kernel of the idea for you?
I think I had written a short story called An Abduction, which is set in the 60s and which is set in the same sort of hyper-respectable, slightly comical home county suburbia, which is nowhere I've ever lived. And I was actually only a child. I'm younger than even Phyllis's children in the 1960s. But for some reason, when I wrote that short story, it really tickled my imagination. I thought, this is fun. I don't know why, but I seem to know how to write this time. I've soaked it up from somewhere, who knows where. And it's sort of a little bit extreme. So it's fun to write and to put up all of that respectability and solidity and stolidity against everything dangerous and disruptive. That generates good stuff in the sentences, is what I thought. So I kind of, it's hard to remember now which comes first, the setting, the story, but I know that I got the story way before I started writing, obviously, but I got it almost all in one. It was as if it unfolded very easily for me. And in fact, in the first 5 or 6 pages of my notebook, it's almost all there, including the ending, including the characters of the children. They sort of came to me whole, this one. It doesn't always come like that. It's sometimes harder won, and it goes through quite a few metamorphoses before I even begin. But this one came very much intact, as it were. So yes, that That's where the story came from. But quite why, I don't know. Where do these things, you know, what inspires them? Why this novel rather than that?
Well, what a gift when they come to you whole. That is rare, I think. So it sounds like it started more with a time period and a sensibility rather than with Phyllis herself, or rather with one of the characters.
They may have come absolutely together, because when you get a character, what you're getting is, well, Phyllis is Phyllis because she begins as that bourgeois housewife. I think I got her from the very beginning. I knew it opened with her sitting at her dressing table with the sunlight pouring through the window and the sort of, you know, the gardening going on outside. And I say you could almost hear the jiggling of the ice cubes in the gin and tonics. That whole lifestyle came to me with her, and she can't be imagined without it. So I think that's usually what it is, that the character and the world and the story of what should happen next, all come wrapped up together. Because Phyllis would not be interesting, or she would only be mildly interesting, if nothing happened to her. The minute you have that contented, petticoated, attractive woman sitting there dabbing l'air du temps at her wrists, you want something to, fictionally, not personally, but for fiction, you want something to shake her out of that, startle her into something different.
I have to point to that opening line, because there is so much contained in it that is the hints of DNA of the rest of the story. So she's sitting at her dressing table in late summer. And I think it's just so wonderful that it's late summer, because that's really, it's kind of the late summer of her life, right? And she's got the, you know, and the window is wide open, which is really how her life is about to become. And, you know, I think gardens are so metaphoric with their Edenness and all of that. So yeah, it was interesting. And you're answering a lot of my questions here, which is that opening contains so much metaphor of what is to come in the book. And so I was wondering when those openings for you as a writer, when that sentence can be understood in its full impact of what it's telling us, if it takes you to write the whole novel and then say, you're right, it's late summer. You're right, the window is wide open. You're right, there's a garden.
I don't think anything's, to get back to our initial word, I don't think anything's innocent as I'm writing that. I from somewhere, and a lot of this is a little bit subliminal, certainly in the case of that paragraph, I know that I meant it's late summer. It's got to be late summer because she's 40. And although 40 really sounds terribly young to me now, I kind of know what it meant for a woman to be 40 then. Actually, that's an interesting digression, in that my editor has, I say just a little bit further on down the same paragraph, I say Phyllis was 40, but she was still pretty, something like that. And my editor said, what do you mean, but?
Yes.
No. In 1967, if you were 40, it was but. 40 was sort of terrifying for women. I vaguely remember my mum turning 40 a little bit later than that. And she didn't want anyone to know. Anyway, so fascinating times, but that's a digression. I think as I wrote that paragraph, and I always write my books in consecutive order. I haven't written that later. Those really were the first words I put down. And usually my openings are pretty intact by the end. I don't think I fiddled with it very much. That was what I put there. And I'm sure I'm aware, at least half aware, dreamily aware of sowing seeds, just as also as she sits there at the dressing table, her son and a gang of kids outside are, instead of obeying the decorum of the lovely, well-kept garden, they are pushing round through the borders, through the hedges, across gardens, being transgressive. And I'm sort of aware of that bright thread of energy and freedom, which is also, you know, is sort of an advance note to the listener, the reader, of the thing that's going to happen, the disruptive energy that's going to coil across the book and upset everything that seems settled.
Well, going back to your digression while we were on the topic, yes, it was slightly wounding to see how Phyllis had aged at age 40.
But I know.
But I certainly understand, you know, 40 is an important age for her to be, for reasons that we won't divulge. But I thought it was such an interesting choice to have Colette, who is her daughter, who is really on the precipice of becoming, you know, an adult. She's a teenage, kind of precocious teenager, and Phyllis on the threshold of middle age and all the things that that means, and this competition between mother and daughter for beauty and for youth and all of those issues. There's so much ripe material in there. You're right. The 1960s, a 40-year-old woman in the 1960s is different than a 40-year-old woman in
I think 60 is the new 40 in 2022. I really do. Yes.
Yeah. Thank you. I feel better.
Not much consolation to me. I'm way over that one.
So it sounds like there's a very significant twist about plot twist about two-thirds of the way into the book, which we also will not give away. But it sounds like that decision was also present if the book came to you fully.
I knew it before. I'm certain I knew it before I started. Sometimes you do forget these things. No, I knew that before I started. I knew, I did, of course, because one of the things it meant was that I had to be very, very careful in the way I wrote Roger. I'll be careful not to say anything that gives away the twist, but it's always complicated when you have something up your sleeve that you might not mind the reader half guessing, but you certainly don't want to spell it out. And I think with this one, actually, you readers won't guess it until they get very close, but you want to be inside the person's head some of the time, and yet you know he knows what the reader mustn't know. So that's a careful piece of manipulating, which I was doing from the beginning. I wanted to have some perspective and some viewing the world and the family from inside Roger so that we could get a feel of his thought. But at the same time, I had to be very careful with his thought that he didn't give away to us what he actually knew. And there was a way of doing that, but I had to steer around it.
Well, yes, that answers a host of questions, which is how difficult it would be to make that realization. And if that didn't come to you until later on, it would be a ton of rewriting.
It would have been all wrong. I think one would have weighed the novel wrong. I had to sort of know that all the way through. I had to know the hidden thing. I had to know it in relation to Roger because it sort of changes who he is. And I had to know it in relation to Jean Knight. And I had to know it in relation to Nicholas, yes.
You have said, I can't remember if it was the last time we talked or if it was in other interviews, that plot is the most difficult aspect of the writing process for you. I don't know if you still feel that way or if your knowing all of these twists and turns is a conscious nod to saying plot is hard for me, so I am going to figure out some big plot points ahead of time.
Oh, I don't, yes, interesting. I think I have got better at it, which is partly to do with, I think I've got better at novels as opposed to short stories, which have a completely different sort of arc and shape to them. And first of all, when I was writing novels, because I so wanted to write novels, I wanted that long span and that follow through. But I did begin with do it rather by putting short stories end to end, if you see what I mean, structurally. And I couldn't quite imagine the great bridge of a novel which builds one end in one piece of land and then spans the water and comes down in the other. The engineering of that was hard for me. And then perhaps from the past onwards, I think maybe I began to internalize it and really feel it. And maybe that came with being able to see the long, slow unfurling of a plot, as opposed to the little kind of knot that comes with a short story or that you need to come with a short story. It's always hard to get that right and to not overplot and not underplot. It's always a balancing act. But I think story, to get the story and be thinking lots of things at once, like how can I precipitate what's contained in the heart of this story? How can I kind of bring all its innards out? But also, how can I entertain the reader? You are thinking that. You're thinking, how can I give them plums, you know, to please them as I go along and yet not be too smart, not be too clever. So it is, and you have to do some real hard brain work on that. You can dream a lot of your book in a sort of almost a sleepy way, and you can imagine scenes. What would that be like? What would that? What could happen there? But somewhere there's some real muscular work to make the plot and the story be its best.
We talked about that last time. You were saying, yes, it's that contradictory requirement of dreaming, taking a bath, a hot bath, and dreaming it. And then, yes, getting down to the hard work.
That must have been, we were talking about the past. I think we must have been, because that it was particularly in the bath that I got some big solution to a tricky problem I had with the past.
So what does it, do you kind of plot this out in your office, or is it all in, it sounds like you definitely keep notebooks and notes to yourself, but do you put it on a big timeline where you can kind of see what happens where?
No, not like post-its around the wall or something. I feel that would become oppressive. Actually, novels do, they become oppressive anyway as you write, even with the pleasure in it. As the book accumulates, it sort of is hard work, and you feel you're dragging a great home, a great house with you forwards, because you've got all these things you must finish off, you must resolve, you've started them. But I would hate it to be pinned up on my wall. I think that would depress me. So I have a notebook. I don't write in the notebook. I write on the computer. But at the front of the notebook is sort of ongoing. It's scribbles and sketches and words and bits. And this needs to come in before the end of the chapter. That at the back of the book, I will literally have the hard information. When are people born? Where did they go? What did they go to school? And the big outlines, perhaps, of what could happen. And maybe questions for self, like maybe so-and-so could do this. Maybe that's where she was when. So the back is kind of for engineering. Then the front is for the ongoing, if this is a ridiculous pair of analogies, but the front is sort of for the close weaving. And I literally have the notebook beside me while I'm working, because when I can't push the next sentence on the page, I'll play with it, with what needs to be in it, in the notebook beside me.
I should have done better homework on this, but I was trying to think how many point of view characters there were.
I think it's probably five, isn't it? Because I think I do Roger and Phyllis, the married couple. I do both their children, although I think we only go inside Hugh's head, the little boy's head, just once when he's alone in the house sticking his stamps in and his awful aunt calls. So, and actually, that was like my favorite chapter to write. I don't know why. There was something about it. I just loved writing him in that house alone and hating this aunt. And then finally, she sort of forces some information out of him, and they're confronted nakedly, not literally nakedly, but in a sort of naked aggression with each other. I actually found the whole thing very funny, even though it's also quite tragic what's going on. So I think I do both their Roger and Phyllis, both their children, Nikki, who is the lover, I think, and Jean, of course.
Jean,
I think that's it. So six.
Okay.
I've never done that sum before, Mari. So that's very interesting.
It is, because I was thinking, and then there's a constellation of minor characters in this space that Phyllis goes to live. There's a lot of people in and around. And so I was wondering, you know, I was kind of picturing it like a big shard of circles where Phyllis is the big giant circle at the forefront. And then there are all these little bubble circles around her of the smaller characters, and how much you have to know and understand about those characters. There's a wonderful woman that she befriends in her new life that lives down the hall and is a nurse. And just how much you feel like you have to flesh those people out in your head, and maybe they don't make it onto, maybe all of that information doesn't make it onto the page, but you have to understand something about them. And I don't know how much of that work you do.
It depends a lot on the people. Because, for instance, another, if you like, minor character, though he plays quite a big role, is Paul, the artist, the working class artist. And I didn't need to know much more about him. He came very easily to me. I could imagine him. I could imagine his background and himself. I think I've known him. But Barbara, the nurse that you talk about, I didn't know much about nursing. So I actually did do quite a bit of just dabbling. working out what it would be to be a nurse and to be a black nurse. We had so many women came from the West Indies at that point to be nurses in the NHS. And I did do some research about all of that. And I really needed to know stuff about her uniform and the sort of procedures of discipline and hierarchy on the ward in those days. So I did find out a lot that was quite fascinating. So it's slightly contingent. It wasn't difficult to imagine an artist, but it was a little bit harder work to think properly and do justice to a nurse. So that comes into play, those sort of questions. I did quite a bit of, it's nothing as technical as research, but I needed to soak myself in Roger's context as well. He's an Arabist working at the Foreign Office. So he spoke Arabic and he knew quite a lot. And I did quite a bit of, just tinkering with that and hoping I was getting that right. I do actually have a son who is a research analyst at the Foreign Office, not as lofty as Roger is. But of course, this is, it's all a long time ago, so things have changed hugely. Britain used to actually be somebody in the world when Roger was working there. It's a little bit different now.
It struck me it would be easy to have Roger as a bit of a caricature, a bit of a stereotype. He's kind of aristocratic and, I just see him in his office smoking a pipe all the time and kind of being removed from everything. Yeah. And so that would be an easy stereotype to fall into. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like all of this deep research that you do makes him not that, makes him fully realized.
Well, I really don't want to take sides in the novel. It's not a romantic novel about a stuffy, old, oppressive marriage and a woman finding happiness and freedom through finding her true love. It just is not that. I mean, to be honest, probably she's, her husband is fascinating. He's actually a deep and complicated man. Personally, I think I probably find him more attractive than Nikki. I don't know. Who knows that?
I did.
Okay, that's good. And I'm that's what I wanted the energy in the novel to be. It doesn't take sides. At the same time, that I hope the novel can feel that there are things in Roger which are fixed and which are maddening and which can't be moved. A certain male certainty. And yet I also want you to sympathize with that male certainty. So that's the lovely work that fiction can do so well, is to just give you all the facets and preclude simple judgments. Yes. Everybody is mixed. Even Roger's pretty awful sister, who we're not that sympathetic to. But actually, I give her at least two moments when, first of all, the fact that she cares for her dreary old mum so patiently, despite being so judgmental herself and so hostile to Phyllis and all of that. She cares for her old mother. So fair play to her. And then I give her one moment when she goes in search of Phyllis to sort of have her revenge on Phyllis in a way. She finds in crazy, dropping out West London, she opens the door of what is Nikki's flat, but there's a young poet woman in there. And I wanted there just to be a vision for a moment where Marnie looks at something she might have been, might have had and hasn't had. And she feels her own plainness, apart from anything else. I give her a line, something like the plainness that she carried around with her like a curse, so that suddenly you feel an unhappiness that isn't meant to be registered the whole of the time, but it gives you a sense of the roundedness of the woman. It's what I think the novel is so good at, is people that you can't close down on. You can't get the final verdict. And yet you have lots of working verdicts. It's not just bland or blank. You feel really hostile to people and really sympathetic with what somebody does, but then turn the page and see it all from a different angle.
My guest this morning is Tessa Hadley. The book we're talking about is Free Love. You're listening to Writers on Writing. You used the word house earlier, and I wanted to get to the houses in this book. And I know we talked about this with the past when we talked last time. Houses are so prevalent and beautiful in your work. And I think it's more of, I think, a common in the UK to name your houses, but your houses literally have names, not so common in the US, but it nods to them being characters in the book and what they represent and how metaphoric they are, the house that Phyllis came from versus the apartment she moved into, and her space keeps getting more and more constricted as, ironically, her life opens up, her house gets smaller. I would just love to hear your take on how houses are characters in your books and how that space works for you.
Well, I've sort of got three different class spaces here, because actually there is a house that Phyllis hardly knows. She's been there once, which is Cressing. Now, that's where we really name houses in this country, is when they're really posh and they do belong to upper class people. And Jean Knight has inherited this mouldering, falling apart, damp, and not wholly beautiful, but great big pile somewhere in East Anglia. And so that's a sort of bit of a dream of past Englishness that is in our DNA, and we hate it and we love it. And it's in Roger's DNA. Actually, you did say that Roger was aristocratic, but in fact, in that horrible British encodedness, he's a grammar school boy. So he's not super posh. He's the product of the meritocracy. Mm. He's a bright boy who's worked his way up. Mm. And Jean is in a slightly different class to him, and she owns this old pile. And at the very end of the book, we go on a walk round Cressing. I've just kept it there as a dream, as a word, as a name, as a vision. I haven't been there once in the whole novel. I meant not to. And then just right at the end of the book, we do go to Cressing. And of course, it's all rather grim and bleak and damp and messy inside. Oh, we do. I'm wrong, aren't I? We do go there. Of course, we have Christmas there with Nikki, where she's everything's in a mess inside the house. Anyway, then Jean and Roger walk round by the lake, and they look across at the house. And from a distance, it looks beautiful and entrancing and like a sort of ideal. But actually, that is just a dream. And close up, it's complicated and unsatisfactory. And right, so that's one house. Then there's the suburban house that Phyllis and Roger live in, which is a bit arts and crafts and a bit cute and a bit cozy and beautifully kept by Phyllis. It's her sort of outer shell, her pride and joy. And then when she leaves it, when she kicks all that away and she goes to live with Nikki in his room, and there are bare boards on the floor and it's sort of freezing, it's just an electric fire and there's no stuff in it, and he hardly keeps it. When he clears it up for her to come and visit him, he just piles his dropped clothes around the edge of the room, and she's reveling in that. It's like stepping out of the shell of the perfected outward self, and she feels, and it may be an illusion, but she feels that something more, she's finding something inside herself that is more authentic, that is free of trappings, free of the shell. That's what she thinks. And there's some truth in it, undoubtedly. It's extraordinarily liberating for her. But what we watch as she then gets her own little place nearby, which is, again, just a room, really, with a kitchenette in it. But she starts to make it nice in a slightly different style, more 60s, more modern, more a bit more hippie, really. Yeah. But there she is. She's actually buying the stuff in the market, the Indian blankets and the cushion covers and so on. And so she starts to make a new shell, I suppose, is really what happens. But it's a new shell. It's very different. It's not constraining. It's improvised and spontaneous in a new way that is lovely for her.
Yeah, every piece is so reflective of the time and the people. And I always, after I finish a book, read the beginning sentences against the ending sentences. And this was so satisfying because we are at Cressing at the end. It's very dark. There's all of this metaphoric, like scraps of black paper and warnings and, you know, torn cloud. Everything is very dark, as opposed to the opening, which is late summer and gin and tonics. So can we talk about writing sex scenes? Because you are wonderful at creating scenes that are so driven by the mind as opposed to driven by the body. And they're as psychological as they are physical. In particular, and I don't want to give anything away again, but in particular, there was a scene where Phyllis's daughter, who is a teenager, late teen? Is she? She's like 16. Yeah.
Yeah. I think she's just 16, going on 17.
So there's a scene where she, and I'll discuss this obliquely so we don't give too much away, but she sheds her clothes for someone motivations for that action are so complicated and nuanced. And yet you as writer don't need to say anything about that except to have her do it. And ultimate example of show, don't tell, I suppose. But you do that again and again through this novel. And I think, you know, sex scenes are very intimidating to a lot of, especially new writers who may get bogged down in body parts as opposed to psychology. And you do that so well. And I was wondering if there's anything you can say about that.
I think I do remember when I took the novel on and sort of started it. And it was not a romantic novel about a passionate transforming love affair. It was about everything else around that as well. But I did realize that and thought, oh, what have I taken on here? I have got to write sexual passion between Phyllis and Nikki. And I did have to. I had to deliver on that. Otherwise, the book couldn't work. It wouldn't convince. So I did have to do that. That scene, though, which is not between them, I did have fun with that. I knew that was going to happen from the beginning, actually. I knew it was part of me doing that leaping ahead and the story coming to me whole. And I thought, oh, yes. And then Colette makes a pass at him. And, you know, but I didn't exactly know what form it would take, except that I knew it would not have any consequences. And anyway, yes, no, I don't, but I have no idea how I do that. Or I don't want to do just body parts, as you say, though, you know, here and there, one has to do enough body parts just here and there not make it seem squeamish, not make it seem as if you're, you know, kind of
prurient or something.
That's right. And so you've got to put on the page the sexual content. But I think if you spell it out and you give it a kind of almost a narrative, this, then this, then this, then this, funnily enough, it's almost distracting. It's as if you invoke, I mean, it's as if it can verge on something pornographic, which has consequences for the arousal of the reader that are not quite what you want. So right. It's funny. You're just doing, you're doing some kind of alchemy on the page, and you need to have the ingredients dropped in there, maybe just in a sentence or a word, which will give the rest to the reader. But you do not have to have a blow-by-blow account, because actually a blow-by-blow account, unfortunate, is not how it feels inside it. It doesn't feel like that inside it. And so it's better to have a slightly more, again, maybe unfortunate, a slightly more fluid sort of account of what's going on, which is a bit more minimal, but it's a matter of put a bit of a body part in there. You know, I remember thinking when Phyllis and Nikki get together that he would see that she had the marks on her body of the holiday in south of France, where she's had her bikini on and she's tanned everywhere else, which is also very 60s somehow. My mum's worked so hard on her tan, and I can remember those white bits on her that weren't, and I just thought, well, that's a way of sort of getting his curiosity about her and his looking at her onto the page, and also telling you stuff about her. How it's quite done, I'm not quite sure. And each occasion is different.
Well, and you kind of come to understand about Phyllis that she's almost having an affair with herself more than an affair with Nikki, because she's of course, you know, interested and attracted to Nikki, but what she really becomes by the end of the novel is more attracted to this new life she has and is discovered in herself. And he's almost superfluous to that. You know, he was the gateway to it, but he's disposable by the end a little bit. Oh, yeah. No, I'm giving things away. Sorry.
Yeah. Again, it isn't that romance story where two people, like two halves of a whole, come together and solve everything. That I knew, I didn't quite know how I was going to do it, but I knew that I was going to contain in the novel at least the beginnings, in fact, more than that, of them not. Now I really am. I'm giving it away now, aren't I? Yeah, I was going to contain the imperfections of and the incompleteness of the relationship. You're absolutely right. Somewhere, he is the gateway for her discovery of her freedom, and she says to Roger near the end of the book, she says, every cell in my body has changed. And she doesn't mean by sex, actually, although she certainly means partly by sex, but she means by this new me, this new being, this new way of being in the world. And again, talking about how I always want to have things both ways, I really want the reader to feel the excitement of Phyllis's liberation and discovery of a bigger self and a bigger world. But I also want us to have some irony about it and think, you know, to some extent, she's naive in, like Roger says, you live in the same world as me. You can't, you know, you can't pretend you don't live in it. And she says, I can pretend, I cannot live in it. I'm not living in it. And he's right and she's right. And I love that in life and in politics, that the sort of, if you like, the pessimistic realism that says you can think you're so idealistic and so rejecting it, but you're living in it like I am, you know, we're all in this same boat. And then the, I love that. That's probably a little bit more what I think, but I also love and think it's indispensable, the ferocious idealism which refuses it, which says, no, I'm not going to live in this world you've made. I want a better one. And I sort of think those two impulses, you know, yin and yang, whatever they are, they're both so necessary to us. And I love being able to put both of them in there in an absolutely an argument that cannot be resolved, not by me anyway.
Well, it goes back to our observation at the beginning that it's really, it's not a loss of innocence, it's a reclaiming of innocence, which is a little bit counter to how things usually go. Usually as a young person, let's just talk in generalizations, but you would marry for love or passion, and then you'd kind of realize, you know, you wise up and then you'd, you know, you either divorce that person or you grow up. But this is the opposite. She married wisely or cautiously or whatever you want to say, and then did the opposite.
That's a very 60s thing, isn't it? To sort of discover that wisdom and being sensible is really also stupid and a waste. So that's, it is very 60s, I think. And I love that greediness of the 60s that wants to live more. It wants more. Women in particular, of course, wanting more.
And yet I still maintained some of those conversations felt so contemporary with, you know, with the world today. I think we're too in it, I think, to know exactly what will become of it. But I do think this tumultuous time does somehow reflect back on that. But maybe too soon to write about it. I don't know.
Absolutely. Of course it does. Of course it does.
Well, going back to some of your wonderful short stories, do you write short stories that I know you must have been writing some of these short stories at the same time you were working on the novel, because they're regularly coming out in the New Yorker. How do you balance those two things?
I do. I absolutely write them at the same time. And I love to do that. It's a novel is, like I was saying, it's sometimes as if you're pulling a whole sled with a world on it by the time you're three quarters of the way through, or maybe it starts to lighten up then. Maybe it's when you're halfway through. And so much as you love it, you sort of need refreshment. And that's perfect timing to stop. I mean, I usually write a short story when at a natural pause point in writing the novel, like at the end of a chapter, at the end of a significant moment. And it's very nice if an idea comes, or there's an idea in my short story notebook, different notebook, which is sort of calling out to me, and I can see how to do it. It's a lovely loosening up of the creative thing. And then you go back to the novel with refreshed.
That's interesting, because I would think, you know, it would pull you so far out of your headspace that it would be hard to juggle all of those things mentally. And the short story requires such a different approach, obviously. But
I think that's exactly what works for me. And I do read about other people, other writers I love, who when they are writing a novel, like write it 14 hours a day and can hardly eat or sleep and live and breathe their characters. And I'm actually not like that. And I don't know whether it's because my writing habits were formed when my children were younger and I just had to stop. It wasn't any 14 hours a day. That wasn't an option. But I think it may just be temperamental anyway. So I do stop when I stop writing. And obviously I am sometimes chopping the onions and thinking about how to, but not that often, more likely in the bath or on a long walk. That's good for solving problems. But no, I am able to stop and be somebody else and come back. And so that enables me to be, not only do that in terms of, you know, life, my yeah. friends, my social life, whatever, but it also enables it in terms of the short story. So it's actually good for me. I really like it. Just to, it gives me a distance on the novel. And then very likely, if I've been away from the novel for 6 weeks or 2 months or something, when I go back, I suppose what I'll probably do is read the whole of it thus far. And it's like reading it with different eyes, sometimes not to the good. Sometimes you think, oh no, what is this? Why am I talking in that funny voice? And I'll have to, you know, I might then see that I need to do something to what I've done, take down the tone or change something. But often just I'll be reinvigorated for plunging in with a kind of freedom, because that's what you're always trying to sustain. And you really should be able to sustain it, is that for all you have got to follow through, you have got to deliver on what you've already set up. It's the point at which that begins to feel heavy that you'll write less well and enjoy it less. So you're trying to keep up this freedom of writing right through to the end of the book as best you can.
As you're talking, I'm thinking about how many writers tell me that the middle is really the worst part of writing. Mm. You know, you have all this energy at the beginning and you know how it's going to resolve at the end, but you have to keep the reader's attention for those 200 pages in the middle.
And you have to keep, first of all, your own attention, because without your attention, you know, you think you're a bit bored. Well, the reader will be 10 times as bored. So the middle is difficult. That was what took me so long for years to be able to even begin imagining how to make enough meat, enough change, enough stuff to do. It sounds so obvious, doesn't it? But actually, when you first think of a novel, you'll have a few good ideas, but you quickly realize, I've written those. Oh no, how am I going to, what am I going to do now? So having stuff to do and being able to imagine that in a way in advance and think, but of course I've got that to do, and then I've got that scene, I've got the scene where Colette, you know, takes off her nightdress, to have these things, big things that you know are going to be generative on the page, they're going to be fun for you, language is going to, you know, fountain out of them. That's very important to have that ahead. And I think getting away from the novel and then coming back into it, for me, sort of regenerates that creativity, I suppose.
Well, that raises a question of, yeah, so you're on at least eight novels, I think. And I have no idea how many short stories.
No, nor why.
And do you find that to be, oppressive is not the right word. Do you find that to be, as you were saying, you know, I saw that there's all this stuff to do and I've already done this and I've already done that. Do you find the prior work to be generative, or do you find it to be, oh, I've already gone there and it's harder to reach for new ideas and new territory to explore as a writer, or maybe more writing begets more writing?
Yeah, so far, touch wood, that's been the case for me. More writing begets more writing. I haven't felt it drying up. I felt the subject matters change gradually over time in a way I'm not aware of in the moment it's happening, but I can see it happening. Maybe more with the short stories, because I have written so many of them. Perhaps a little panic sometimes, thinking, have I got a new story? But then a new story comes. I mean, the world is very various. And
true,
it's always throwing up new things. So I'm kind of hoping to write next. It's in such a minimal form at the moment, as in I've only just started, but a novel with an old woman in it. So she'll be 80-ish or a bit more, and that will be, I think that's going to be hard, but it will be very interesting to do. It won't only be her, of course. There'll be a whole cast of characters around her.
Are there ages in which you delight in more or less? Because you really, it felt to me like you were having a lot of fun with Colette, who was a teenager, and you felt, you know, very comfortable with a woman in her 40s grappling with all of that. So I was wondering if there are ages where you feel like you sing a little more.
I think it's much easier to write ages which are younger than you. Now, alas, that's soon coming to really cover the field very effectively, because you've just, I mean, it's so obvious, just because you've been there. So you're kind of confident that you have some idea. And that is why I think on the whole, writers don't write old people so well. And we shall see whether I can, you know, whether I can make this novel sing, as you say, with an old woman at the heart. Because I haven't been there yet, so I don't completely know what it would be like to be 82, but my mum's 90, so I'm watching her.
Well, we talked the last time about coming to, I don't think you came to writing late, but you came to publishing at 46. And I just think that's the greatest thing for writers, is that unlike a lot of other professions, you get better and better with the more life experience and all the richness of whatever life gives you to put into a novel that, you know, is a dissident. There are so many advantages to being 20 and so many.
writing so is not one of them. We should at least have some.
Yeah, right.
Yes, I agree. I totally agree. And I also, I'm sort of, in retrospect, wouldn't it be terrible if I had been publishing since I was 26 and I'd written, goodness knows, you know, 20 novels or something. I'm nothing wrong with writing 20 novels, and some great writers have written lots, but it sort of seems excessive. I always wonder, what would Mozart have done if he'd lived on to be 60? Would he have written 60 or 80 great operas? We'd be lost in them. We wouldn't know, you know.
Right.
So this, anyway, so it feels nice to have written 8 and to imagine I might have another 1 or 2 in me. And again, I'm touching wood. Is it tiring writing a novel? I don't know. I don't know how long one can go on doing it. We shall see.
But it's such a compulsion for you. You were talking about, you can't, there's something in your DNA that can't stop, which I think,
But I do wonder whether short stories would perhaps satisfy that. And they don't require the same life investment, but who knows? Who knows? Who knows?
You had talked earlier, maybe it was the last time we talked, about the thing that took you so long to kind of get your writing legs under you those years, was that you didn't feel like you had a strongly formed authoritative self in your writing. And I kind of wondered when you felt like that came about. Was it with the publication of your first novel? Because you so easily slipped into writing regularly for The New Yorker around that time, which here in the US is, you know, a writer's dream.
I mean, I think the feeling of being authoritative inside my sentences and knowing what I was talking about and having something to say, certainly not knowing whether anybody wanted to hear it or read it, but thinking at least, that's me. I think that. I saw that. I imagined that. And I know what to think about it and what I want to say about it. That feeling came in a few short stories kind of just before, when I was in my mid-40s, and I knew that I to go with that. It felt like something different. It didn't feel as if the awful novels I'd been writing and failing and throwing away had gradually, incrementally improved. It felt like, that was all a mistake. This is what I should be doing. And it felt almost smaller. I had been trying to write other people's big, magnificent books and failing. And instead, it was as if I looked inside and I found small things I knew and began to tell them. And that was the difference. And I've actually been thinking, and I've said this once or twice recently, it was around that time of beginning to, if you want to call it this, find my own voice, that I was actually writing a PhD, critical PhD on Henry James. And I wonder whether the easy confidence I had in those sentences, I'd always been very relaxed about being a critic, almost arrogant. I thought I knew how to do that in a way that I was so unarrogant about fiction writing. But I just thought, I know how to do this. I think this. This is what it is. And that rehearsal of authority and confidence and in my sentences, writing the PhD, which became a book on Henry James, I think that lent me great confidence, new, it just made me find my home inside my sentences in the fiction as well. So it wasn't Henry James helping me, but it was me in nonfiction and then somehow able to transfer that certain, that certainty is not the right word, but that self across into what I was making up.
Yeah.
So it began in some short stories, and then in a way I had a sort of insight that if I put some short stories, wrote them about the same people in chronological order and put them end to end, maybe I could make a novel. And that was Accidents in the Home. And I knew I had, it was me, and it felt small. It was just domestic, and it was just a family with all its bits and pieces and stepchildren. And I knew all about all that stuff. It's not my family, but it was intimately known to me. And I knew how to talk about it in a new way. And that felt just lovely.
There's such an Alice Munro-ishness to it. Yeah. Yeah.
I think Alice Munro was also part of the getting there, just reading her and seeing her make her stories out of her world and the ordinariness of it, which is not at all ordinary. That she was actually, it's fine, you mentioned her, she was very important to me.
Mm. So the parting advice is to get a PhD. I like
it shouldn't work, should it? And I think the world divides into writers who desperately don't want to ever be critics because it will spoil it for them. And then I'm not one of those. Actually, do you know, weirdly, I really think that did help. But I wouldn't recommend it to everybody.
Well, on that note, are there other pieces of advice that we should have gotten in here that we didn't?
Well, I would always say just read. Yeah. You know, good writers are always readers. Otherwise, anyway, why would you want to? But not just that, it's fertilizing you all the time, even if you're going to be so different. Start close to home, it is write what you know, but you'd be surprised how much you know. You know all kinds of things that have never happened to you, but you know them.
I love that, because I think a lot of writers have a hard time embracing the authority to write about something that feels so foreign and scary. Some people do it effortlessly, but I think there are a handful of people that are intimidated by that. So Tessa Hadley, this is always a pleasure. I just love our talks. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Mary. I loved it too. Really enjoyable. Thanks so much.
That was Tessa Hadley. The book was Free Love. You can find this and other episodes on our websites. Barbara's is barbaradamarcobarrett.com. Mine is mariestone.com. Or you can subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, and Stitcher. Music, sound design, and editing provided by Travis Barrett. Thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.